not here today at all. That's why you're sitting next to me. All right. The House Committee on Revenue for February 21st, 2018 will come to order. We'll reopen the public hearing on House Bill 4007 to complete our testimony from last time and see whether we have any additional witnesses on that bill. And if my recollection is, the two Seans were up next.
Sean and Sean.
Yeah, so here they are. Oh, and we have some new people, too.
Both spell it the same way, you know.
Okay. So let's hear from the two Seans, and then we'll go on to the new list that I have today. When you hold over a public hearing, you always get some new people added in.
Thank you
very much for being willing to come back today. We appreciate it.
It was a stretch for us, Mr. Chair.
I understand that.
2 days in a row. For the record, Sean Jillian's representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. A pleasure to be here today in support of House Bill 4007 with the -A12 amendments. I thought maybe I would start with a little bit of background around the document recording fee, how it actually came into being in the legislature, and sort of how we got to where we are now with this, what we perceive as a robust housing package. For years, those of us who were intimately involved in housing fought over different funding sources and how we should fund housing at the public level, what level of investment should be there. And we actually reached a point where we had to hire an outside mediator to come in. And after years of defeating each other's bills and arguing back and forth, a year's worth of mediation got us to the point where we all decided that the document recording fee was an effective way to fund certain housing programs, particularly affordable housing around rental units is where the vast majority of the doc recording fee goes, both to the preservation and the building of it. And that came to fruition in 2009 when a broad group of stakeholders supported the doc recording fee at $15, and we agreed to oppose some other things as well and different funding sources. So fast forward to now, when we found ourselves sort of having similar conversations and we each had our own ideas about what the best solution was for the particular housing crisis that we're in, and I think we came up with a comprehensive, robust bill that strikes the right balance, because anytime you're talking about increasing taxes, that obviously you're cautious with that, and you'll notice that the bill does actually have the three-fifths requirement on it, because it's been determined by legislative council that this is in fact a tax, because it does not directly benefit those who pay it, and that's sort of what you see here. So we feel like we've reached a critical balance of how much of an increase we would see in the document recording fee. Mr. Cleave can sort of touch on the impetus for the first-time homebuyer savings account, which is the first part of the bill. And then after that, Mr. Chair, I know you had some specific questions around income limitations and sideboards. I'm happy to answer that after Mr. Cleave goes.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors in support of House Bill 4007. This concept, the portions regarding the first-time homebuyer savings account, came out of a real estate-driven work group. We regularly meet as an association on the national level, and many states had started experimenting with first-time homebuyer savings accounts. Montana was the first to adopt in the late 90s. Since then, Colorado, Iowa, Minnesota, and Mississippi have all adopted similar programs. Really, there's no silver bullet when it comes to housing policies, but one of the issues that we have seen is a steady decline of first-time home buyers. 10 years ago, first-time home buyers made up about 43% of the market. Currently, they're around 32% of the market. A healthy housing supply is illustrated when you have a robust segment of purchasers on every level. of the housing market. We think that a bill that would encourage savings at the personal level provides an opportunity for people to start thinking earlier about becoming part of their communities by investing in real estate. I know from my own personal experience that my opportunity to build wealth and security for my family started when I made the first investment in my first home about 15 years ago. The mechanics and the sideboards that Mr. Jillian spoke about, I think he can give you the most details about those. It is a subtraction from Oregon income, so an individual that would be making $60,000 a year would be able to deposit up to $5,000 if they're financially able to and not pay Oregon income tax on those deposits. So it's an amplifier for savings. We think the sideboards and the mechanisms for saving over a period of time means that an individual with the means to purchase a house wouldn't actually utilize the program. However, we did the Assembly one better by putting in those strict income caps within the system. And rather than belabor the committee with the details, I will just say that we do have a economic study that took into account not only the other states that have adopted this program, but the 2010 federal tax credit that was provided for first-time home buyers as well. So we believe that the opportunity to build a good program from House Bill 4007 is in front of you now, and are very excited to see this bill move forward.
Very good. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Is the federal program congruent with the plan in this bill?
Mr. Chair, at this point in time, there is not a deduction for a first-time homebuyer savings account at the federal level.
Okay.
What Mr. Cleave was referring to was during the recession, there was a tax credit that you got, which originally was refundable, and then it actually became a full credit later on, and that expired. That was just during the middle of the recession.
Okay. All right. That's helpful. So what we're talking about in the first-time homebuyer portion of the bill basically would allow people who qualify within the income limits and because they're the owner of the account would get a reduction in their state income taxes based on the amount they contributed up to the limit.
Yep.
But the federal income taxes would still be payable under the system that we currently have in place, knowing that Congress could change that on a moment's notice or less.
Mr. Chair,
you don't need to respond to that last question.
Well, and I think what you will see, though, as more and more states adopt this, you'll see a push by our national association to push for it at the federal level. One other thing that I wanted to touch on from yesterday that you mentioned, which was a parent contributing to this account and whether or not they would enjoy the tax benefits of that. They would not under this bill. It's simply the account holder. Now, they can put it in there if they would like to, but they won't get a subsequent reduction on their taxes.
Great. Any other questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Mueller, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. How would this align with pre-existing ability for people to contribute to their
IDAs.
IDAs, yeah. Good question, Representative Bueller, committee. The program that which the representative is asking about is the individual development account, and I think that provided the foundation for the conversation for this bill. IDAs are set at 80% area median income. So qualifying, you have to be at or below 80% median income. There is a lot of counseling that goes along with that for financial stability. And the individuals that do participate in that are able to meet matching funds in the deposit. So a NGO or another housing entity could be making a matching donation that doesn't count as income for the individual under those scenarios. This does not have that provision, though. It's only for the account holder.
And the limitations in this proposal are quite different.
Yes.
Quite a bit higher. but it doesn't have the benefit of, it does not have the benefit of someone else contributing a matching fund.
Yes.
And Mr. Chair, I would add, Representative Bueller, when you're limited to 80% of area median income, it's very difficult at that income level to actually purchase a home. And even if you can manage to get the down payment in order to make the mortgage payment, it's very difficult. And so what we've seen is historically the focus has been on 80% and lower of AMI. We're really trying to shift the focus more to 80 and 120% and even above. And I've cited statistics for you all in the past of effectively you need to make closer to 120 or 150% of the area median income to even buy the average home in many parts of our state.
Really what we're looking at here is what I like to describe as the donut hole. Those people who don't have the means to purchase a house outright or don't have the means to come up with a down payment, but people who wouldn't qualify for the IDA account either. We're seeing prices rise steadily, much faster than incomes that have been able to keep up with. But there's a lot of contributing factors to that, let alone that we're on the West Coast. We have beautiful weather and generally nice neighbors. But it is a strong concern for us when incomes can't keep up with the rate of real property increases.
I think if you asked people who actually do the counseling as part of the IDA program, that they would tell you that this is mostly having to do with vocational development.
Yep.
And education, and the dollar amounts that it's possible for people to put in actually conform better to that kind of use, which of course is why they're called development accounts rather than housing accounts.
Yeah, it's a double whammy, yes.
It's a double whammy. I think the housing piece is sort of a little extra.
Yep.
I'd be surprised if it's used much by people who qualify for that account. I could be wrong about that. I just don't know. Representative Bueller, does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. Let's see. We have some other people who want to be heard today. Thomas Etienne, Peggy Lynch, and Jody Weiser, please. And Peggy should know that we did hear from a representative of the league yesterday.
Oh, okay.
But you may have other things to add. Whichever.
Okay, well, so I'm Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. I did not know that somebody came yesterday, so I apologize. It was a snow day. And I wanted to make sure that we were on the record to point out we do have a letter, Exhibit 23, but I really wanted to point out how important and how significant the document recording fee, the programs that are supported by the document recording fee are. They are programs that exist today. They already work. They already provide help for emergency housing, for home ownership. And so it's really important that we continue to move forward and provide those kinds of monies. It would have been fun to sit with Sean Gillian, since sometimes the realtors and the league doesn't work together. So it was fun to be able to say that we also support this and the Dash 12s. Thank you.
Yeah. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Jody Weiser for Tax Fairness Oregon. On the second page of my testimony, you'll see a comparison of what it would cost. What would you give to the state in each of our neighboring states in the capital cities? In Olympia, if you're buying a $30,000 house, a $300,000 house, you pay $5,526 in fees. In Sacramento, you pay $306 in taxes and fees. And with this adoption, you would pay $362. This is not, we could be charging much more and we wouldn't be changing home ownership. Washington State is actually the state with the highest home ownership rates of the three states. So this is definitely a move that will help people who need help get into homes, whether it's to own a home or to have just a place to live, and we're very pleased to support it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Hello, it's Thomas Etienne. I am a U.S. Army veteran, graduated ROTC out of Portland, University of Portland. And I came back to Oregon in about 2016. And the first thing that really hit me when I saw the streets of Portland was how much more homelessness there was. And immediately I knew, oh boy, some of my old, you know, people I used to serve with are out there on those streets. It's just, you know, veterans and homelessness are kind of inseparable, unfortunately. So I don't have a tremendous, you know, kind of a technical argument or anything to offer to you here. I just have to try and represent, especially on the component of this bill, which is allocating 25% that's supposed to be dedicated from the revenue portion to assist veterans. And yeah, I sent in a letter, and it's really just, it's just an argument about what's owed to those people. I'm very lucky. I got all my fingers and toes attached. I went out to Afghanistan. I went out to some of these things, and I came back, and I'm in good shape. I feel like, okay, I'm lucky in a way, and I still feel an obligation to try and speak about those things. We've been at war. It's going to be 17 years straight this year, and the impacts of that on the people who served are considerable. They're substantial and they're real. I just met a guy on the corner outside walking in here, Joe, former U.S. Air Force, Fort Collins, Colorado. He used to manage a Burger King, and now he's living outside collecting cans. And yesterday I met with a young guy, younger than me, an Afghan vet, who is, we were discussing, he is a property owner, lucky for him, a tech guy up in North Portland, and he is considering to build an ADU on his property and then to invite a low-income veteran or someone to live there because he thinks it's that considerable. So anyway, I've gotten involved with some advocacy here in Portland. I became the chair of the Veterans Caucus with the DPO. And I don't know what else to say. If the amount of, I wrote that, I mentioned that in the letter, the amount of kind of acclaim and prestige that we give to the military in the public arena and public events is very considerable. But then when you get into the functional side of actually dealing with the consequences, it's nowhere near as much. So that's why, you know, some of the representatives asked me to speak on this or encourage veterans to come down here, and I figured I might as well do that and just say that piece, that this stuff is important, and we need diligence from our lawmakers. That's what we need, and that's where, you know, that's where we find trust in the systems that are supposed to take care of us. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions for this panel? I'd like to simply comment on Mr. Etienne, on your comments. I think that it is clear in the legislature that housing is a giant issue for the state of Oregon. It's not a little issue; it's a big one. We are struggling with how we can be helpful in an environment in which we cannot pay for the basic services that that are the state's responsibility already before counting housing, without looking at that at all. This bill, if it is approved, is a small step in the right direction. I emphasize the word small. The people who actually work on these issues all the time and who would, I'm sure, like to do a lot more, I will also believe recognize that a bill like this is about what we can do at this moment. But your point is exactly right on. I mean, I live in Eugene. I see the same kind of thing in Eugene that you're describing. And the prices of homes is out the roof. You heard the people representing the construction real estate industry testifying essentially the same way. And I think you should go back to the people you represent and let them know that we are committed and we're doing our best. I appreciate your testimony very much.
Can I respond?
Please.
All right. I appreciate that, too. I forgot to mention that in the larger sense, and I agree that the homelessness and housing issues is not an Oregon problem. It's not a Portland, Eugene. It's a national problem. But if you don't think national security is impacted by housing and then the other big ones, your health, your education,
right. These
things, if you don't take care of them, watch out, because that's when I came back here, and some of the reason I came back to the States is the fact that I started to recognize some of the indicators I saw in these other places I was fighting in, that we're fighting in, as, oh yeah, this is how you destabilize a society. Yeah. This is how your governance services don't reach the people in a meaningful way, and at some point they will step away, and then terrible things can happen.
Right.
And I don't want to see that. You know, I think we need nation building right here, and yes, I agree.
You're describing the things that I sometimes think about when I'm having trouble sleeping at night. And I appreciate the comment that I'm glad that someone besides me is thinking these thoughts. And I have to tell you, I suspect other members of the panel also are thinking about them. And you're absolutely right. America is not immune to the kinds of issues that affect other people around the world, and we need to be aware of that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else from this panel? Thank you. Well, Mr. Cowan, please.
Chair, excuse me, committee members, for the record, my name is Tim Cowan. Since mine is going to be pretty, describing each individual part of the bill, I wrote it down for you so you could follow with me. I think we need to have an understanding that allows the public to understand what's going on, because it's not uncommon for people who need the housing, they don't understand what's available, and if they may not even ever think they would ever qualify. So when I talk about financial institutions, I was a senior vice president and regional manager for First Interstate Bank of Oregon, had Mid Valley, Central, and Eastern Oregon. So what I'd like you to do is consider in section one, defining what is a first-time buyer, and is there anything that needs to be changed as we go through the discussions. Number two, financial institutions. Well, it doesn't include state banks. And what about homeowner financing? Not uncommon for an owner of a home to want to sell it without going through a financial institution. Can an extended family qualify if the funds are dedicated to a family member? And I'm thinking in terms of a trust. Section three, I see no issue in requiring an eligible financial institution to report their position on these accounts. And for example, I talked with the Oregon Bankers Association yesterday. I used to be on the board and was official spokesman for them, and I see no reason why financial institutions can't come up with material, whether they're brochures or whatever, to explain it and have people qualified to do that in the branch. Section 4, an account holder may claim a subtraction or exemption for a period not to exceed 10 years. And it talks about not exceeding $50,000. I thought for a certain point that this was for lower income, and it was to help people in minorities and that type of stuff. Probably if they can get $50,000,
we'll get it. Yeah.
They probably don't need as much help.
This one, aren't you?
Section 6, limits. They can deduct $10,000 on a joint tax return, and at $6,000 it goes up to $158,000. Kind of interesting that we're talking about people with joint tax returns and pretty good income. I see no reason why they can't qualify for housing. Section 9. I found this kind of interesting because we talked about investment, mutual funds, and that type of stuff. What happens with capital gains? Is it a good way to defer taxes? Because in the 10-year period, you can accumulate a lot of money in investments. I need to know, and I think we need to look at how you define minorities, because now we have so many different groups I think would be considered minorities. I want to make sure that we cover all of them. Then the last thing, does this statute discriminate in any way, shape, or form? And we need to take a look at that. So those were some of the things that when I looked at the bill, I thought might be of interest for you to take a look at. Okay?
All right. Thank you. Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Colleagues, I asked you to look at the first-time buyers piece yesterday. Won't ask you to comment on it today unless you want to, but we do have the work, the bill scheduled for work tomorrow. And if there are, Mr. Cowan has raised a number of the potential issues that we ought to be thinking about. If you have concerns or questions, be prepared to bring them, unless you have them today, in which case we could raise them now. All right, thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4007. And I'm right, Chris, am I not, that we scheduled this for work tomorrow? All right, okay. We'll open the work session now, and I've closed the 4007. We'll open the work session now on House Bill 4027. Colleagues, there's been quite a bit of activity on the issue, which is now embodied in the Dash 9 amendment to this bill that would have that has to do with the cemetery clawback, property tax clawback issue that came up after we had our initial public hearing. There are several people who wanted to be heard again about it today, and so we will hear from some of them. But why don't you give us an overview of where we are? And I think the Dash 12 is where we start on this. Would you give the committee an overview on the Dash 12 and then the Dash 9, and then we'll actually talk about the Dash 9?
Okay.
Please.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. The Dash 12 amendment incorporates what was the Dash 6, removing all the solar language from the bill. The Dash 7, which limits the gigabit property tax exemption on intangibles to 1 year and then repeals the exemption. And the Dash 3, which extends the low-income property tax exemption housing for 6 months to align with the property or with the tax year. So that's the Dash 12. And then now we have the Dash 9, which is so current law allows that cemetery property is exempt. However, if that property gets converted to another use, that triggers a 10-year clawback on the property taxes that would have been owed. And we have a proposal and a specific case here that we're looking at, but this would propose to take that property that was used as cemetery and property and exempt, and if it's transferred to a different use or sold and then transferred to a different use, specifically low-income housing, it would not trigger that 10-year clawback, and then it would remain exempt under the statutes that govern low-income housing property tax exemptions.
Thank you. Okay. I think that's probably enough.
Okay.
Ryan Fisher and Ariel Nelson asked to be heard again. They here? On this issue, and then also after them, I have the cities, the League of Oregon Cities, and Mr. Garst from the department. Please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. Ryan Fisher here on behalf of Rest Haven Memorial, and I thank you for your time today. And
thank
when
you,
I spoke is. With you before, we were waiting on the amendments to be drafted, and so I will speak briefly to the Dash 9 amendments. What we are trying to do here is pretty simple. If there is land that is currently being held in tax-exempt status as a cemetery, and it is going to be developed for affordable housing under one of the existing affordable housing exemptions, we don't want to penalize that transfer of use from one exempt status to another exempt status. And so what the Dash 9 amendment does is it identifies the existing affordable housing exemptions and says that if the land that has been receiving the cemetery exemption is being purchased for the purpose of providing housing that will be exempt from property housing taxations from those cited statutes, then there will not be this 10-year clawback. So we feel that this is a really important thing to get done. There's a particular project that would be able to develop 172 units of affordable housing. And we think that there may be other opportunities around the state where there could be some available land within the urban growth boundary that could be developed for more affordable housing, which, as the chair indicated on the previous bill, is a very big issue. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. For the record, Ariel Nelson with Oregon Housing and Community Services. We just echo some of what Ryan has said and just note that, Oregon Housing and Community Services, as we fund affordable housing around the state and have been out and around the state on our statewide housing plan outreach, have heard that local communities everywhere are facing housing need, a severe lack of affordable housing, and are actively engaging in looking for increased local tools and flexibilities to bring much needed affordable housing. And this opportunity in Eugene with the ability to do so statewide, this is land that's sited in prime residential areas next to schools and amenities. This is a development who has already been in contact with our office and is exploring coming in the door for some non-competitive funding resources. Our 4% low-income housing tax credits, meaning the funding is there and available to them. They're in the process of seeing about coming in the door for that. And it's the kind of opportunity and opportunity for low-income tenants that we really like to help make possible.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Rushkey, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming. My question is just for clarification. So the tax exemption for cemeteries, is it the same as the tax exemption for low-income housing? Is it comparable? I mean, are we comparing apples to apples? Or
Representative Barnhart, Representative Rushkey, they are in separate parts of the statute, and they have their own requirements that you have to provide to show that you are meeting the requirements within those statutes. I believe that there are some differences in terms of how you qualify, but in terms of the amount of taxes that are exempt, that those portions, to my understanding, are the same.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Do you believe this amendment's ready?
We feel that, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, we feel good about this amendment. We have heard this morning some of the specific concerns that the City of Eugene has brought forward. We feel, looking at these, that that those concerns are addressed in the current language, but we're open to listening with them and potentially fixing this. If some of these concerns do play out, we'd be happy to fix those in the Senate, but we feel good about the dash nines.
Thank you. Representative Finley, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. I would ask the same question that I asked you the other day. When this body is granting property tax exemptions, I want to ensure that the people that maintain those accounts are in full support of it. And I'm not sure that's the case in this manner. I mean, in not only in support of this effort, but in as well as able to support this effort with infrastructure and other measures. I'm not sure that all that is ready for that. So,
we'll be hearing from the city and also the league on that point.
Okay, thank you. So I guess that was. You nodded your head in an affirmative, so I appreciate that.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Finley, I would like to at least say that this amendment would not in any way change any of the land use requirements that would be called upon, or any of the infrastructure requirements that the housing project would require, and it wouldn't change the requirements of the affordable housing exemption. So it would not in any way make it easier or change the conditions of that affordable housing exemption. All that it would do is it would say that if you are able to pass all of those requirements that are already there and the land has been used as a cemetery, you won't have to pay that 10 years of back taxes once it moves forward. But it's not in any way changing those requirements.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Let's hear from the City of Eugene, the League of Oregon Cities, and for convenience, let's call up the department at the same time. Even though I'm sure their issues are different. And when I asked you to be prepared to comment today, I was interested primarily in your concerns about the specifics of the Dash Line Amendment, because that's what we're dealing with.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. Ethan Nelson, I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Manager for the City of Eugene, and thank you for allowing us to talk a little bit about the Dash 9 amendments. So I think that if we take a step back, there's two basic issues here. One is a policy process, and then the second is then the specifics of the amendment. From the standpoint of previous testimony that you had heard earlier on House Bill 4007, you engaged in a large discussion, multi-stakeholder, around affordable housing processes and incentives and ways to bring that forward. This amendment hasn't really gone through that process, and it's around affordable housing, yet it is specifically a property tax item that impacts taxing districts. And to my understanding, we haven't had very good discussion around the impacts to the property, to the taxing districts regarding this amendment. And so that's a process issue. And I think that what that does is that then it shares, it kind of bleeds on into the specifics of the amendment are indicative that that process has not been robust and brought together us multi-stakeholders around this concept of underutilized lands within a city's UGB. And how best to move those forward for productive use around housing crisis. And so in particular, and if there's questions regarding this actual Eugene project, I can answer those from a land use standpoint, but really this is a statewide property tax exemption issue that local governments should be heavily engaged in because it impacts their bottom line general fund dollars. And so, but in regards to the specifics of the current proposal, we don't think it's ready. There's a lot of language in there that is not clearly defined and could lead to unintended consequences, particularly the clawback provisions should be a local option. They should be determined at the local level of what the criteria are rather than having those determined statewide. Second, we believe that when they in the language it talks about the land is being purchased. Well, that's really hard to define in one community to the next. For Eugene, it might be much different than in Portland or in Lakeview or in Ontario or across the state, right? And so we're going to want to know what that being purchased really means and ideally leave that to local governments to establish. And then the last piece is in regards to the definition of how long that transaction takes. And so currently the amendment is written so that there's no definition as to when that change of use happens and when housing needs to be put onto the site and in use. And so theoretically, somebody could get, an entity could get the tax exemption, the clawback exemption, and then hold on to the property as being, quote unquote, in development for affordable housing indefinitely. That's not clarified within the bill, and so in the amendment, and so we've got concerns about that. I'll turn it on over to my colleague from the committee.
Thank you.
Can I ask one quick question about that?
Representative Smith-Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. But again, this is permissive, right? So the city could still, they would be able to decide whether to grant that exemption or not?
My understanding, Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith-Warren, my understanding from reading through the amendment and having our legal staff look at this and our land use staff is know that if it changes use the way that the amendment is written right now, that it is determined at the state level and not at the local level. And so we wouldn't have any determination onto that part of it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I think at the previous bill, you mentioned how important housing is and what kind of a crisis we have. We are looking for all the tools we can find, and we're committed to that. We would like to be in support of another tool, but as my colleague from the City of Eugene noted, we're just concerned that this tool isn't quite, doesn't have the right sideboards. We think that we should be able to opt to have this type of clawback lifted so that we can get more housing. But the, how the existing three housing programs that are listed here would work with the taking the clawback off the table, how those two issues work together isn't real clear. The first paragraph of the bill on lines 9 and 10 lists that it's going to be exempt if it's under one of those three programs. The first program is the Housing Authority program that the Housing Authority has some ownership or partner or such. The other two, the 307-515, that section, and the 307-540, those two are local option housing programs, and both of those allow a property tax exemption. The second one is if it's a nonprofit owns it. The first one is just a low-income rental. You get to determine, the cities have to, or the county adopts those two programs, and then it includes during the time you're using it for low income, or it's in development. So this would cover this type of situation, but the time period is described in both of those programs as a reasonable time period as set by the local government. So we don't have this construction lag issue that seems to be missing from this bill. So if it was just those other two programs, clearly then we don't have this delay problem, but there is no, it's an automatic exemption in the Housing Authority one, and then we got the two permissive, and now we have this clawback on top of it. And so it's just not clear. Do you have to have the acceptance in one of those three programs, and then you get the clawback taken off, or is it you get the clawback taken off, period, because you bought it with the purpose of getting in one of these programs? So we think that it needs to be written more clearly that the clawback will be removed if 1, 2, 3, yeah. and it's clearly written that way, that you've applied and gotten your exemption, because one is looking back and one is going forward, and it's just not written in a way that is crystal clear. Sub two again says that when it will be due, but there's not a point saying what the delay is, when the delay counts. And so And looking at line two, it says notwithstanding, and it has two statutes. The second one, 311-411, this committee wrote a couple of sessions ago to say you have to have a certification if you're going to take it. If a nonprofit is going to now buy this property, you have to make sure that we don't have taxes owed on the books so that we actually tag the right person when there is a clawback. And now you're taking that one off. And so we want to make sure if this deferral, this clawback doesn't work out right, who is on the hook? And now we're taking it totally off the table in this situation, and we want to make sure, is it the developer? Who's going to be on the hook again? And again, that's just not crystal clear here of how this would work. So again, just to summarize, we think this is a good idea. This type of land is not being used, and this would be sometimes in ideal locations. But when it's written for one project, this would apply across the states, we're just a little uncomfortable of how this might be used by developers and in conjunction with the existing programs. So for those reasons, we can't be supportive of the Dash 9s at this time.
Thank you. Department.
Chair Barnhart, Mark Garst with the Oregon Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. So I just have a very small issue. Sorry to bring it up so late. We just heard before the hearing that the property was going to need to be partitioned before there would be a sale. And I just wanted to point out that there's also a requirement that potential additional taxes be paid back when a property is partitioned. So I would hate for you guys to do the hard work of passing a piece of legislation and have it not work for the particular piece of property that is of concern. So I think it'd be fairly easy to fix that if it does need to be fixed. Again, just found out about this and haven't really done my full homework, but if it did need to be fixed, I imagine it could just be a notwithstanding clause. But I just want to make sure that if there are any amendments contemplated, we'd like to be involved. That's all.
Thank you. Thank you. Questions for this panel? I would disagree, I think, with one of the things, Wendy, that you said. I think that the wording is pretty clear in lines 7 and 8. If the land is being purchased for the purpose of providing low-income housing, then they get the removal of the clawback. I think that is pretty clear, and it isn't, of course, what we would want to do. We'd want to make sure that the low-income housing actually got built and was put into use. I think that reinforces your argument and doesn't detract from it, if I understand.
Chair Barnard, some people think that they have to do the application and get approved, and that would be that will be exempt. But you could also read it as it's being purchased to be exempt, and that's more in the purchaser's mind, and that's what I'm concerned about, is which is it? I think it's you got to have the application using one of those three programs.
You know that in the tax court, bill, the laws are written, read literally, and that means we have to be hyper careful to make sure that the literal reading of the language gets to what we're trying to get to, not what somebody thought it might mean. And I appreciate your raising this. Colleagues, let me just say that this came up, the history, this came up after the public hearing. It was presented as an idea having to do with the cemetery that we've already heard about in Eugene, just outside of my district. It's an area I'm extremely familiar with. I was strongly tempted and obviously fell into my temptation to allow this to be considered as part of this bill, in the hopes that we would actually get there in this session. I'm now convinced that we're not getting there this session, or at least not in, with this amendment in the House. And so while we allowed this kind of extraordinary process where we never held a hearing on it, but we've heard quite a bit from the proponents and now people who would love to get to the same result but can't get there using this amendment. So my what I'm going to propose is that we leave the Dash 9 alone for today and we work on the rest of the bill. And having said that, does that generate any more questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Representative Smith-Warner?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 12 amendment to House Bill 4027.
Representative Smith-Warner moves the Dash 12 amendment to House Bill 4027. Would you remind the committee again what that amendment does? We just talked about it, but there are so many moving pieces in these bills we're dealing with. I'd like to make sure the committee knows what we're voting on. Please.
You did a very good summary before.
The Dash 12.
Summary would be great again.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. The Dash 12 incorporates the Dash 6 amendment, which removes all solar language from the bill. It includes the Dash 7 amendment, which allows the gigabit intangible property tax exemption to remain in place for 1 year and then repeals it. And it includes the Dash 3, which extends the low income property tax exemption sunset for 6 months to align with the tax year.
Thank you. Any discussion on the Dash 12? Any objection?
I have no objection.
Okay. Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Smith-Warner, please.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4027 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Smith-Warner moves House Bill 4027 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Could we stand at ease for a moment, please?
Yes, we'll stand at ease.
Thank you.
The committee will come back to order. The motion on the floor is to send this bill with a do-pass recommendation as amended to the floor. House Bill 4027. Any discussion? Objections to the motion?
Can I just make
a comment? Yes, please. Representative Buehler, please.
I know we're moving very fast in this process, but you know, when I checked just 45 minutes ago, there was no revenue projections on this, at least I could find in OLS. So,
thank you.
I mean, I think it's very hard to make these decisions when you don't see any revenue projections until the time that we're trying to vote on things.
Thank you. I think that I neglected, and I appreciate your reminding me, I neglected to ask about the analysis, and so we should be doing that before we send the bills to the floor. I assume we have an SMS, a fiscal statement, and a revenue statement, and that they're somehow posted in OLS somewhere.
They weren't 45 minutes ago or an hour ago.
They're not currently under the analysis section.
They're not in the analysis section. That's.
They're in meeting materials
and exhibits. All right. I'm looking for a revenue statement that includes the Dash 12. Must be down there near the bottom someplace, huh? Thank you, Representative Buehler. I appreciate your calling us to task on that issue. So I had I've been so involved in the details of the bill that I forgot a basic step.
First item there, RIS.
This is the gigabit, and we did see this document yesterday.
So the revenue impact statement for the dash 12.
Oh, the dash 12. That includes the other piece.
Yeah. So we have the gigabit component, the low-income housing component, but then the part that removes solar has no impact because there's no solar.
Right.
Right.
We
didn't renew the RETC in the last session.
So if you'd like me to talk about the revenue impact statement.
Why don't you do that and tell us how we got to these numbers.
Okay.
And what they mean.
And just, I'm slow on.
Please go ahead.
So that is, okay, I got it. Okay. And so just in terms of process next time, so this is always under meeting materials, mm-hmm. and then later moved into
analysis. It's only an analysis once they're engrossed.
Okay. Okay. Thanks.
So the analysis was done under. Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. You might remember the presentation that I gave the other day, and looking at sort of contingent scenarios. But the hypothesis is that at some point the companies that have applied for the gigabit tax exemption would be likely getting that exemption under current law, and so. Affording them the exemption in this biennium is revenue neutral. So if they would be getting the exemption, say, in 2018 or 2019, then giving them the exemption in this year has no impact. In the out years, because the current law is, the current statute is repealed regarding the gigabit exemption, there is a revenue gain for the amount that would have been exempted. And that's approximately $35 million per biennium. And then if you broke that down into the local governments and education districts, you get around $23.3 million, $11.7 million. And those correspond with the numbers that were in the flow chart. But this is 2 years instead of 1 year at a time. And those are the two companies that have applied. So those would be the two companies that qualify under current law, which would also be the two companies that qualify under the 4027.
Okay. Now, if you made the opposite assumption that DOR wins the controversy,
mm-hmm.
the numbers are reversed then, aren't they? At that point, we'd be spending money this biennium and under this bill mm-hmm. and have zeros in the future biennia. Wouldn't that be right?
Thank you, Chair. If you assume that the Department of Revenue would deny the companies the exemption and that the courts would uphold that, or they would never have to grant the exemption, yes, that is true. You would have a one-time tax expenditure given, which would be a revenue loss in the current biennium. And then since it was repealed, you would have revenue neutral going out.
Right.
Does that
The colleagues, one of the problems when we deal with these sorts of issues is that it all depends on what the assumption is that you make for the base. And we are running into that on a number of the bills we're dealing with this session, where if you make one set of assumptions, it looks like a plus. If you make a different set of assumptions, it looks like a minus. And you have to understand in a fairly sophisticated way what we're doing with this measure. As I understand it, and I hope Rep. Notes will correct me if I miss it, as I understand it, in addition to the six-month extension that we're making for the one little piece, on the other piece, what we're doing is we're establishing certainty. We're saying that the companies will get this tax break for this 1 year. There won't be any controversy about it. The DOR is not going to be able to object about it because we just say it's done. And then they won't get it in the future. That's what the bill essentially does. And depending upon what you think the outcome of the current controversy is, these numbers may be right or they may be switched.
I think you summarized it accurately, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Knowles. Any other questions, Representative Buehler?
No, thank you.
All right. Are we ready to vote? Are there objections? Do I need to call a roll? No objections. Okay, the motion carries without objection. And the bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Knowles, will you carry this bill for us?
Sure.
Representative Knowles will carry it. Sure. I appreciate it. Close the work session on House Bill 4027.
Thank you.
Colleagues, we're going to carry over House Bill 4088 till tomorrow. I think it's already posted for tomorrow. It's not ready to work yet, and we're waiting for some developments in the Senate. We will open the work session on House Bill 4028, and that's Kyle's bill. Kyle, would you let us know where we are on that bill? Colleagues, I have an old, I'm not sure where it is now, I have an old cheat sheet, which is number 145964 in our system. That covers this bill, and it may include the pieces. I'm not certain. Which pieces are we talking about today that we have ready for the floor if the committee should choose to pass them out?
Okay, Mr.
Chair. Go ahead and describe that for
us. House Bill 4028, we have the -7 amendment, which is a combined amendment of the -1, the -4, and the -5. So just as a refresher, the -1 was relating to the housing lender, so that was the definitional change for the nonprofit and the manufactured housing owner. So that's the -1.
Go ahead.
The -4 was the change to the film and video credit. The change is really a technical change about appropriations, with the idea being giving the legislature the authority to top off the account, if you will. So if you auction $10 million worth of credits and the limit's $14 million, the legislature could then appropriate that $4 million in the same fiscal year. So that's the -4. And the -5 is the credit for a manure processor and collector. This had the definitional change relating to bovine and cattle, so that was flushed out a little bit. And then also the technical change in timing calendar year and fiscal year for Department of Agriculture, which has the certifications.
Okay, and what's the number of that amendment now?
That's the -7.
-7, okay. Okay, and then there's other amendment?
And then we have the -10 is the new auction credit. This was described by Representative Marsh yesterday. We don't have the paperwork on this one. We requested the fiscal a little late, so we're still getting that put together. But we do expect to have that available by tomorrow.
Okay.
And then the -11 is the changes related to the working family household dependent care expenses credit. And so that's the one that's directed primarily at students, whether they're part-time, full-time students, a single filer, or a joint filer. We do have the paperwork, I believe, on that one, along with the revenue impact statement as well. So I'm happy to go through that now if you'd like.
I think we need to go through it if we're going to talk about it.
So those were posted to OLS after the meeting started, so you may need to refresh your screens to see it. But this is, again, the -11. Okay, so the -11, again, it's setting up a structure primarily for students. And again, there was some change in Senate Bill 162 in last session that was allowing a non-married student to qualify for the credit. So this is a refundable tax credit that's relating to expenses for, primarily this would be childcare, but it could be in cases where a spouse is disabled or something to that effect. But it's to cover costs. I'll just use childcare for simplification purposes. And then the credit is a certain percentage of those eligible costs. And there's a federal credit similar to this. Oregon's is a little bit more expansive and deviates, again, even further with how Oregon would treat students. But so to think of the credit, you have the limits on the qualified expenses, so that could be the child care expenses. So Oregon has hard cap limits there at $12,000 per year or $24,000 per year, depending upon the number of qualified individuals you have. So that could be an example of whether you have one or two children. And the second part is actually figuring out the credit percentage. So what percentage of those expenses would qualify for a refundable tax credit? And there in statute already is sort of a chart that as you move, as your adjusted gross income moves up towards 100% of federal poverty level, you get an increased percentage to apply to those expenses. So your credit grows over time. And then as you move past 100, I think it's 110%, your AGI is 110% or more of federal poverty level, the percentage starts to move down. So you can think there's kind of almost like a bell-shaped curve in how this credit works. So the policy change with the Dash 11 is maybe the easiest way to think of it is the attempt is to move students that are less than 110% federal poverty level up on that bell-shaped curve and give them the full, in this case, what would be the, I guess the highest credit percentage would be 75%. It depends upon how old your child is. So that tapers down, but it's moving those students up as if they had, in this case, a higher percentage of federal poverty level income. So it gives them the highest percentage based on the child's age.
We haven't had any testimony on this particular piece, have we? I mean, we've had testimony on the policy issue, but yeah, not on this amendment, have we?
No, this amendment, this is part of what was the Dash 9 with a further slight technical change that got caught, but no, there hasn't been a whole lot of discussion since the amendment has been fleshed out and presented.
Okay. And you have something up on the screen.
Yes, that's the revenue impact statement.
For this amendment or for the whole bill?
This is just for the Dash 11 amendment. So just related to the working family household credit. The revenue impact statements on other pieces of the bill are leave their, the Dash 7, which is the more technical change, the three amendments, the 1, the 4, and the 5, those are and then we have the Dash 10, which is auction off credits, that's limited to $9 million, so there's a revenue impact of $9 million per year for that. That'd be the Dash 10.
And that's the one, that's a four-year sunset?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair. So that's up on the screen right now, so that's just would be $9 million per tax year for 4 years. So it's estimated at $36 million, assuming we can sell the full amount of the credits.
I see. So one biennium that this extends over would be 18, but the other two would be 9 because it only reflects 1 year in each of them.
Yes, Mr. Chair, yeah, because it's for 4 years. And there could be a little bit of timing there. There is an ability to carry forward the credit if you're unable to use the full amount. However, these would be taxpayers purchasing this credit. So one would assume, and what we've seen from the film and videos, there's pretty good full usage of the credit in the year following, or the tax year in which you purchase the credit. So there could be a slight tail there, but.
Okay. Colleagues, I think, and please comment, I think I would like to consider the weatherization credit, which we won't have paperwork on until tomorrow. I would also like to give you a chance to review this, and I think maybe we may want to get Representative Kenny Geyer in to tell us about this particular amendment and how it got constructed so that we actually understand it properly. So my suggestion is that we hold this over to tomorrow. And that but we're running short on time. We're going to have to move these things right along if we want to move them. Any other thoughts on that? All right, I think that's what we need to do. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 4028 and carry over the work session on that bill 4028 till tomorrow. And we'll ask Representative Kenny Geyer if she wants to come or send someone to talk to us about the Dash 11, and I'm assuming Representative Marsh that if there are questions about the Dash 10, you can talk about those tomorrow.
Sure.
All right, fine. With that, we'll close the work session. And colleagues, unless I missed something, we've completed our work for today. You have
35.
You have 35 minutes extra. Spend them well. Committee's adjourned. See you tomorrow. I might just.